Welcome to Life and Sirens, Behind and On the Scene, a podcast by first responders. We're your hosts, Sophie,
Jamie,
and Aubrey.
The content provided in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any medical institutions, emergency medical services, or healthcare organizations. Patient privacy is a top priority, and all discussions involving real-world emergency situations are de-identified and altered to ensure confidentiality. Always consult with a qualified healthcare professional or your local EMS protocols before making any decisions regarding patient care or medical practices. Listener discretion is advised, as some topics may include discussions of real-world emergency situations.
Welcome to another episode of Life and Sirens podcast. We're excited to have you, and we have a pretty fun topic today. We're talking about ketamine and all its versatile uses in EMS.
We've started to use it a lot in the pre-hospital setting. It's got a lot of unique pharmacological properties, so it's really versatile. We're going to talk about a couple different ways to use ketamine in EMS. So do you want to go through the pharmacology of ketamine and kind of how it functions out the gate?
Sure. So first off, just a very vague definition of ketamine. Ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic with analgesic and sedative properties, if you didn't know that already, which you probably did.
So ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist. I'm not even going to try to say all of the things that NMDA stands for, but it induces dissociative anesthesia. And so not only does it provide profound anesthesia, but it also provides sedation and amnesia. And it preserves your airway reflexes, spontaneous respiration, and cardiovascular stability. So just out of that, you can imagine what it could be used for. So let's start with our first and most important use for ketamine, which is
pain management. If you've been in EMS for any amount of time, you've probably used ketamine for pain management. It's ideal for burns, for trauma, for any sort of fractures that require any sort of acute pain management. Ketamine is great for that.
I have a really cool statistic from ESO.
Ooh, yeah.
Ooh.
If you are in EMS, you probably use ESO. I know that doesn't, it's not across the board system, but it's our charting system and they do a lot of research. But this just says a study of the prevalence of use of ketamine, which was primarily not as expansive even in 2021, was that over 11,000 EMS patients received it in 2019. And think about how far we've come with ketamine.
Wow.
Wow.
I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
They were already. I can't imagine what it is now.
That is really cool. And in pain management, you can use it as an adjunct. And a lot of times that's its intended use. You use it as an adjunct to opiates and that are opioids. And that will reduce your overall opioid requirement. And then that reduces the risk of your respiratory depression. And so really it just kind of elevates that amount of pain control. And so people use different doses for their ketamine pain control. I think the generally accepted dose is 0.1 to 0.3 mg per kg, and that is a sub-dissociative dose. So it keeps you out of the dissociation range, and that ideally is going to keep you away from some of the side effects of ketamine, like emergence reactions, and our concerns with those. Have you guys experienced emergence reactions when you've given your patients ketamine?
I have had some patients behave interestingly, but I've never had them be upset about it. I've never had a negative response from one of my patients.
I had a man that he got ketamine. He had a pretty extensive traumatic injury with a significant amount of blood loss. And we used ketamine for pain control because he needed many a tourniquet and those hurt really bad. Because as we know, ketamine has a pretty low duration, as a short duration, which is great for a lot of things, but you have to dose it pretty frequently. I was a new medic. I was new to ketamine dosing, and I was probably a little too far out on each of his dosages, so I was not keeping his emergence reactions at bay, and his was just to yell. He would just yell.
And that's actually pretty common. That's one we see.
He would shoot up. He would just yell, and it was really just like a very dull just pretty consistently.
Yeah.
And then I would be like, hey, bud, you're okay, and he would look at me and go, okay, and would lay back down.
Well, that sounds middle of the road for responses, for
sure. Right. That was the first emergence reaction I ever experienced. And it was pretty benign for what I anticipated emergence reactions being like. So that was interesting. Now, with your pain control dose, because it's ideally sub-dissociative, you should not experience that. But everybody's body chemistry is different. So even if it's intended to be sub-dissociative, just be aware that they could reach a dissociation range.
I think it's also important to talk about the onset and the effects and peak effects and kind of the half-life of ketamine, especially in our uses. So for IV administration, the onset is 30 seconds to a minute. The peak effect is going to be about a minute to 5 minutes. And then for the IM dose, you're going to see onset 2 to 4 minutes and a peak in 5 to 10 minutes. And then IN, typically the onset is 5 to 10 minutes and with the same peak effect of 5 to 10 minutes. And so I think that's important to remember is that your onset is very rapid, but so is your half-life. So fear not. It's one of the shortest half-lives of any of the analgesics that we use typically.
So one thing that I think is really interesting about the pain management dose is that if you do accidentally reach yourself into the dissociative range because it's so short, a lot of times, and I don't know that we're the only EMS agency that does this, but a lot of times I will dose a patient, like not necessarily right before, but close to right before we go into the ER, because I know that their assessment and things are going to take quite a while for them to get pain control on board. And so a lot of times that becomes a habit just based off what ER you transport to, that you will give them a pain dose prior to bringing them in. Be conscientious if ketamine, if you are in a dissociative range.
100%.
Because sometimes what that looks like is altered mental status.
And I will say too, so your half-life for specifically the IV duration is only 15 to 30 minutes. So if you wanted to maybe adjust things a little bit, maybe in your 15 minutes out, you could give that dose. I know we're typically used to giving that fentanyl dose or that Dilaudid dose like right before we go in. If you could adjust that maybe a little bit for ketamine, so possibly we don't put anyone in a panic when they believe that your patient, before they've gotten EMS report, is altered significantly. That might be a good option.
So that's pain management. What else can you use ketamine for?
So many things. We love ketamine.
Here is a topic. Hypermetabolic behavioral emergencies, previously known as
the most controversial, please don't use this term anymore, it is problematic,
excited delirium. I know that there has been a lot of controversy around this topic and around the use of ketamine in these situations. However, there is still a need to give these patients sedation to alleviate their hypermetabolic state that they are in. There is still a need to treat these patients. But with that, there is a huge call to be very diligent. As with any time that you're giving a sedative, there is a huge call to monitor your patients, do an assessment on your patients, and treat your patients accordingly.
So I think that when you're talking about a hypermetabolic behavioral emergency, it is counterintuitive to think that these patients are fragile. Because a lot of times they seem to us the opposite of that. They can be extremely agitated. They are very strong. And sometimes when it's paired with those behaviors that are violent, you think that they're not fragile. But truly, these are some of the most fragile patients that we have.
Absolutely. This is a true medical emergency when you are in true hypermetabolic behavioral state.
Absolutely. And their bodies are really on the brink. They're so heightened and to such an elevated level that, one, we need to stop that event. We need to stop that hypermetabolic event within their body. But secondly, when we do, there's always a chance that they're going to decline, and they're going to decline rapidly. And the risk versus reward of that is by not stopping that event, they're going to decline
eventually. Suddenly. And it's more sudden.
Yes.
Yes. It's going to be fast, and it's going to be a large collapse.
Yes.
The goal is to control bringing down that elevated hypermetabolic state. And the reason that we want to do that is truly to preserve their organ function, their perfusion status, all of the things.
Absolutely.
But you have to be, like what Aubrey said, you have to be diligent. You have to recognize that these patients are fragile. So this is not just stopping an outward behavior. You are stopping a lot of internal forces.
Absolutely.
And you have to monitor your patient accordingly. You need to monitor this patient the way that you would monitor somebody in severe respiratory distress, the way you would monitor somebody during a cardiac arrest. you want to have every possible monitoring capability that you have on these patients. Sometimes that means that monitoring comes after the sedation because you have to be able to monitor them.
Right.
But I think that that's something that we fail to talk about, is that these patients are not just big and scary. You also have to recognize that they're fragile at the same time.
They are very sick. If you're in this true state, you are at risk for sudden cardiac arrest, extreme tachycardia and hypertension, acidosis in the form of rhabdomyolysis, hyperthermia, I mean, respiratory risk, including respiratory arrest. Like, you are very sick. And I think that's just a reminder, we're treating this medical sickness. We're not treating the behavioral side of it. We do need to get them calmed down so we can fully assess them, but the reason we provide ketamine in this situation is to eliminate the kidney damage and the risk for cardiac arrest and all these very scary things that can happen.
Yeah, last year we did a scenario at one of the paramedic schools in our region, and we presented all of the paramedic students and the EMT students with a hypermetabolic behavioral emergency patient. And it was right when this topic really became controversial. And it was very interesting to see the hesitation in pulling the trigger on sedation. And I think that, rightly so, it's good to be cautious, but also you still have a duty to treat that patient. And afterwards, because this was kind of our plan, it was kind of a social experiment, just as much as a medical patient. And we had made them two different sets of discharge paperwork that we handed them after the scenario. And if they had sedated their patient, they had a set of discharge paperwork that said, you know, blah, 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 they got discharged within this many hours, good to go. If they did not sedate their patient, then they ended up having an ICU stay, they had an acute kidney injury, they were dehydrated, they went to rhabdo, all of the things. And I think that was cool because they got a firsthand look at being able to see the difference that maybe a seemingly small treatment made on a patient. And that's real life.
Yeah, and even outside of the use of ketamine and the controversy there, within that scenario, we also added in the presence of law enforcement. And we wanted the students to realize how to effectively work with their law enforcement to, one, keep everybody safe, but also keep their patients safe. And watching people try to navigate that interagency relationship was very interesting because we are clearly all civilians. And so navigating the relationships with law enforcement, we've all grown up with law enforcement really being like that ultimate authority. And to be able to work hand in hand with them with something that those officers, and this was by design, not saying that all officers don't understand, but the ones on this scene did not necessarily understand the risk that this patient was under. And that was a really interesting part of that scenario, was watching them figure out the interagency relationship to make sure that we could all work together to keep that patient safe. So as far as your dosing with ketamine, with a hypermetabolic behavioral emergency, really follow your local protocols. It's really going to come down to your medical directors. There is an appropriate range that's generally accepted as like an IM dose for the specific patient population. Generally accepted is like a 4 to 5 mg/kg IM. People use less. I have not heard of anyone using more. I think that that is really the max on the dosing range. Some services will use less, and there is some sufficient evidence to show that less will work. Just be conscientious that hypermetabolic does not always mean wild and off the wall and trying to beat you up. So you may have patients that are far more manageable that are still having a hypermetabolic behavioral emergency. So learn how to identify what those are and what they look like and treat accordingly.
Absolutely. And remember that you're not just treating a behavioral issue. So there's other, you know, things you may need to assess and look for that you may not think of in your typical behavioral patient. Those include assessing for hyperthermia. These patients can become hyperthermic pretty quickly. And then also any kind of measures to combat the, you know, possible damage they're causing to their body. Like, we might need to give fluids. We may need to, you know, do some respiratory interventions already. We have no idea how long this person's been in this state. So just make sure you are treating the medical causes. That's the whole reason we gave the ketamine, so that we can find out what's wrong with this patient.
And this is a hill that I will absolutely die on. Just remember that physical restraint without chemical restraint is problematic.
And dangerous. You can still hurt yourself. That patient can still hurt themselves very badly if they are just physically restrained.
Yeah. So a lot of times in the past, I think not only have a lot of us done it, but if we haven't done it, we've witnessed it. Mm-hmm. The answer was always physical restraint. It was officers. It was cuffs. It was hard restraints. It was soft restraints. It was sheets. It was straps. It was all of these things. And we have better ways now.
Absolutely.
Far more ethical and compassionate ways to manage behavioral emergencies. And so if you are to a point where you are physically restraining your patient, consider chemical restraint as a better alternative. Again, follow your local protocols, your medical direction, all of those things. But keep that in the forefront of your mind.
Absolutely. We've come a long way. But does anybody remember when we used to pronate patients? We did not. This was before my time. But pronate patients in between two spine boards.
What?
I saw it happen. I've seen it happen. And it was like a thing. Like people would do this.
Or to restrain people?
Yes. Pronate them on a spine board, their heads to the side, and they put another spine board on top of them. This was happening.
So the only pronation that I ever witnessed was to pronate a patient, sit up the stretcher, not like to Fowler's, but like probably at like a 45, yeah. Sit up the stretcher so they were like kind of like hyperflexed. And then soft restrain behind their back. And then cot straps.
That's still, I would not recommend that.
So it kept a lot of the pressure. And this was considered the better way.
That it was considered pressure, the standard way.
I mean, it's better than backboard sandwich for sure.
Absolutely.
I have seen it. It is wild. Yeah. Like, why did we ever?
Right.
And that's on progress in EMS.
Correct.
Like, just because we've done it a different way before doesn't mean the way that we're doing it, which does have some risks, doesn't mean that that was better.
Yeah, I would argue face down backboard sandwich was far riskier.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is cuckoo bananas. Sure. I'm unsure why anybody said that's great.
Right. Shout out to our last episode. If your reasoning for doing anything is because this is the way we've always done it, that's crazy talk.
I'm terrified of you.
Yeah. No more backboard sandwiches.
Let's transition from this cuckoo banana scenario to something where we can slow things down and make sure our patient is as comfortable as possible. And I cannot stress enough how much I advocate for procedural sedation, especially in the way of, or in the scenario of cardioversion. If we can, we should. Because you better sedate me if I'm going through that. That's terrifying. All right, what you got, Obs?
As Sophie said, anytime that you're doing a cardioversion and it is feasible, absolutely provide that sedation. Ketamine is a great resource to have for that.
I don't know about you guys, but if I was going to be electrocuted, I would really appreciate it if you would help me not remember that event.
Especially if I was really sick and had to be electrocuted, that's already a high anxiety situation. So please don't do that to me.
Yeah, if you're putting two sticky pieces of bread on me and telling me lightning's about to run through them, I'm gonna be mad.
That's a whole different kind of sandwich.
So whenever you're using ketamine as procedural sedation, typically your dose will be 1 to 2 mg/kg, and it'll get you in that sedation dose.
And I think where we see people getting into some questionable areas is when they mistake their procedural dose for their pain dose. So just to be clear, those are two different doses with two very different effects. So just keep that in mind when you're dosing your patient. If it seems like a lot, it is a lot. If it seems like the smallest amount ever and it's ridiculous, it's probably the right amount for pain.
Yes, if you're using a 1 cc, depending on your concentration, because ketamine can be used for so many different indications, a lot of people carry a relatively stout concentration of ketamine. So ours is 510, which is quite a large volume, which gives us some interesting conundrums when we are using IM dosing for hypermetabolic behavioral emergencies. But it also puts us in a bit of a conundrum when we're doing pain dosing, because if you've ever pulled up pain meds with a 1 cc, it's a weird vibes.
Yes. It's like 0.25, 0.3. Like, it's a very small amount, and it feels very strange.
Really, the only time that it is comfy to draw up our dosing of ketamine is when you're using the procedural sedation dose, because it feels like a normal amount.
100%.
Yeah, so 1 to 2 mg/kg IV. And then if you've ever been present in an emergency room when they do procedural sedations for reductions of dislocations or setting fractures or casting, things like that, you will notice that they very meticulously monitor airway. These people go on end tidal. A lot of times there's an RT present when this is happening. So same deal. If you're going to cardiovert someone, I would say that's our most frequent intervention that we would use procedural sedation. Put your patient on NTIDAL. Make sure that all of your monitoring devices are in place prior to this.
That should be a standard of care. Anytime you're giving a substance that has the potential to cause altered mental status, you should always be on NTIDAL. You need to have something that can as closely and as accurately monitor hemodynamic stability as possible.
Do all the things. It's not going to hurt you. Put them on the monitor. Put them on NTIDAL.
Just do the 12 lead.
Get the data. Just get the data. More data is great.
It is. And I know we like to die on the hill of, but if we do that, it's ALS. If you're doing this, it is the most ALS thing you're doing. So calm down.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We are so far. We are past that.
This is serious business. Speaking of, I know we talked about this a little in the beginning as some emergence reactions. I had a patient where we cardioverted the patient. We did use ketamine as our procedural sedation. And as they were coming off the ketamine, they shouted over and over again, "Too much delight," that they're a cowboy. Woohoo.
Oh my God.
And I mean, it was phenomenal.
I feel like that would be Jame if she ever got ketamine.
You're damn right it would be me.
Moving from procedural sedation to RSI / DSI.
Ooh, what's the difference?
Rapid sequence intubation is kind of like going out of style a little bit.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's because we realized that...
That kills people, Carl.
Stop, you have to leave.
Yeah, I think RSI is going a little bit out of style. I think it's because we realized that rapid is not always like the answer. I think quick and controlled,
yes,
is really the answer. Rapid, no thank you.
I think the key word in either one of these is sequence.
Yes.
It just has to be in this order,
mm-hmm,
for safety reasons.
And when I really think about the way that I have always RSI'd and the way that I've seen a lot of providers before me RSI, it honestly was more delayed sequence innovation.
I think generally it is.
Yeah. Generally, people will push their sedative. They make sure that this patient is in a good sedation spot.
Yeah.
And then they'll push the paralytic. And that is so intuitive to me. I don't ever want to push a paralytic and not know if my patient's sedated.
Absolutely.
I don't
want
to like slam back to back and be like, we'll see. Hopefully they don't start crying. Like, I will not risk looking down at a patient that I'm intubating and just see like tears.
Yeah.
No. I will sedate you and wait. We have BVMs. I can bag you. We're going to pre-oxygenate. We're going to put a cannula on you. We're going to high flow you. We're going to do
nitrogen washout.
Yeah. Ooh.
Whoa.
So, when you're looking at your airway management, RSI or DSI, so either one, I think you know which one we prefer. Ketamine is a fantastic induction agent. But you do have to be conscientious. So traditionally we use a sedative agent, we use a pain control agent, and then we use a paralytic. Ketamine can be both your sedative and your pain control, which is fantastic. But be aware that it does not have a respiratory depression aspect. It also does not depress your gag reflex. So if you, I don't know if people are still doing this, but do people still do like medication assisted?
I think there
innovation?
Are some states where that is the only option they have for most field medics.
For most field medics, if you find yourself in a situation where you're doing medication-assisted intubation, so you have a patient that is kind of on the edge, and then you're going to give them some medicine to assist with that intubation, ketamine is not your boy, because it does not reduce your gag reflex and does not reduce your respiratory drive. So these patients are going to remain intact in that regard, and you're going to be in an uphill battle.
Yep.
For sure. If you do use ketamine, pair it with a benzo to help you over that edge, or an opiate, whatever your protocol says. So why is it useful in airway management? What kind of things can it do?
Well, one thing it can't do is dry secretions.
It can't.
Cannot.
Be aware. Pre-medicate.
So within airway management, so we talked about RSI, we talked about DSI, but what about other airway interventions? Can ketamine be used for other stuff?
Ooh, this is so fun. I'm excited. And I think this is one of the ones that people don't often think about or know about because it's not a standard of care. But it is an interesting and effective method of care for a lot of scenarios. Ketamine in severe asthma. If you didn't know, ketamine is actually used for bronchial dilation. So ketamine has a direct effect on relaxing the bronchial smooth muscles. It acts on the NMDA receptors by inhibiting calcium influx. So it makes it especially effective in severe bronchospasm or those status asthmaticus patients, especially when we're really trying to avoid intubating these patients at all costs. So why don't we use every tool in the toolbox possible? It also serves you in the way other sedatives might not, and promotes your hemodynamic stability, so you don't have significant risk there. And then your respiratory drive in these low doses, which it is for asthma, it won't affect your respiratory drive there.
That's very cool. Yeah. What's the dosing for asthma?
So it is a subdissociative dose as well. It's an IV dose, so a bolus of 0.1 to 0.2 megs per keg over 1 to 2 minutes. And then a continuous infusion after that of 0.1 to 0.5 megs per keg per hour. And you can titrate that as needed. So very effective and very, not very often used. But it's something to consider if you want to get medical control on board.
Yeah, it's just another tool in your toolbox to be able to at least call for orders for.
And obviously you're going to start with your typical treatments for these asthma patients or status asthmaticus patients. So you're still going to provide the albuterol and the steroids and maybe the MAG and all those things. So just, we have tried everything else. Now what?
Is there anything else strange, or not even strange, but that we don't traditionally use ketamine for that it can't be used for?
Ooh, this is some up and coming hot EMS goss right here.
Ooh, Aubrey's got the goss.
The hot goss. Yeah, so there are some studies going on right now, well, actually, that have already been conducted, that shows the efficacy of using ketamine in status seizures. So if you've had failed therapy with benzos, and typically these patients will already be, we're talking about like inner facility here, they'll already be on an anti-epileptic, like Keppra or something like that, and if the seizures are still not controlled, they have been getting ketamine. And a systemic review reported that ketamine was effective in controlling refractory status epilepticus in approximately 70.3% of adult cases.
Dang.
Wild.
Which is wild.
That is incredible.
And then that same review found about 61% in pediatric cases, which is also crazy. So I think that this is something that we're going to start to see.
Especially in critical care transport.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if it's not something that is within protocol, it is yet another tool in your tool belt to be able to call and at least ask for orders, and or at least just have in the back of your mind that this is an option if we get to this point in the road of these very sick patients.
That is very cool. And if you know anything about like our current seizure protocols and what we normally use, benzos act on your GABA receptors, and then ketamine acts on your NMDA receptors. And that is significant just because it decreases your excitatory neurotransmitters. And so it basically, ketamine is just like, can you chill?
Can you please chill?
So with ketamine use in seizures, that's super cool. It also, another cool part of it is that it has neuroprotective effects. So it could reduce secondary brain injury caused by prolonged seizure activity or status epilepticus. Also, hemodynamic stability. And we've talked about that in other regards as well. But unlike benzos or propofol or, another sedative agent, ketamine does not typically cause hypotension. And it's an excellent choice for your patients that have been in status for a really long time and they're becoming really clinically critical. Ketamine can help kind of bridge that gap, which is cool.
That is incredible. That is life-saving right there. Mm-hmm. That's so significant. We are going to see more of this coming up.
Yeah.
And if you're in a position where this patient is needing airway management, ketamine's also a kind of a bridge to your RSI. If you have a patient that's in status, it can be kind of a dual use, which is really cool. So that's what we've got for you for ketamine use in pre-hospital medicine, pre-hospital and inter-facility care, and some new up-and-coming things. But ketamine is used in a lot of other places too. It's used in a lot of lifestyle and treatment of some more chronic conditions. What do those look like? What else can we treat with ketamine?
a new method of treating things like, for example, chronic pain or other chronic conditions. More specifically, we're seeing this low-dose ketamine in a chronic use for depression, especially patients with PTSD and complex PTSD. And there are significant studies that are showing this is the new method. And right now, we're often seeing that these patients have to fail, you know, 5 or 10 different, you know, antidepressants or other medications to control their mental health or psychiatric conditions. But we're moving to a point where this is becoming actually a first line, where these patients aren't having to suffer through failing medication over medication, and the efficacy is there.
And it's saving people's lives.
Absolutely.
Patients that repeatedly fail treatment, especially with chronic depression, PTSD, things like that. If you're failing treatment within these conditions, your risk of suicide and your risk of self-harm and really like life-ruining behaviors goes up and up and up every time you fail a therapy. So it's really cool that there is a therapy that can kind of stop all of that out the gate.
Absolutely.
Which is pretty nifty.
And I don't think that this is necessarily new medicine, but I think what's becoming so exciting about this is that it is becoming so much more accessible. And I think that that is huge.
Yes, and you may hear, so we classically are calling this medication ketamine, but more specifically, this is esketamine. So it's a little bit different. It has emerged as a treatment for this resistant type depression. And it's typically administered in a nasal spray in a clinic. There's medical administration of this drug in the clinic, but there's also a psychiatrist on staff when this is happening. So they're doing a lot of amazing things.
And it's cool. Ketamine, so similar to all of the different ways that we've talked about already, the way that it works, it treats PTSD and depression in a similar way, just kind of a different aspect of its mechanism. So it's the same thing. It's the NMDA receptors. It blocks them. It also enhances the activity of a protein or a chemical called glutamate. And that's your brain's primary excitatory neurotransmitter, which sounds a bit counterintuitive, but it promotes synaptogenesis. So basically it promotes the formation of new neural connections. It's thought to repair and strengthen neural circuits that are damaged by chronic stress, trauma, and depression. So it can increase your neuroplasticity and really truly help you create new neural pathways or repair the old ones that you keep running down consistently, which is very cool.
I think what also is so unique about this treatment is how rapid.
Absolutely. I was just
the onset. Yeah, how rapid the onset is compared to traditional antidepressant medications.
Absolutely, because you get put on antidepressants and they're like, I will see you back in a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we will see if you are still big sad
but
or
this
not.
Could cause you to want to kill yourself. It could make it significantly worse.
Yes,
it so
could.
If that happens, sorry.
And if it does happen, call me and I will immediately call 911. I think everybody that listens to us knows how we feel about the mental health realm in EMS and in just medicine in general. It's not handled very well in a lot of different avenues. And this is something that is so cool because you have somebody that has severe depression, severe PTSD. They can go in and they will feel better within hours. It will be an improvement within hours. And then you continue to do those infusions every couple of weeks. And I think everyone's frequency is variant, but every couple of weeks. And it has been shown to be especially effective in people that have suicidal ideations.
Yes. And almost always, at least in the studies, and this is how the medication is delivered, it's paired with, you know, an antidepressant or some other chemical drug intervention that you're going to take every day. But I think we see a lot of relapse prevention too, and studies have shown that esketamine has been effective in preventing relapse in patients who have achieved remission. A study found that continued treatment with esketamine nasal spray, even as infrequent as every 6 months to once a year, have had significant delayed relapse compared to the placebo patients.
So in these you go get a ketamine infusion to treat one of these conditions. Is that it? Like, you just go to ketamine, or do you go to therapy? What else do you do?
Patients who receive esketamine as a therapy for depression are often encouraged to follow their treatment day with a therapy day. So you need to be in therapy as well, typically. And the therapy is so effective on these second days or 24 hours out from treatment because of your ability to process and the promotion of, you know, your synapses and all this to go along with it. So these patients are on a medication, they're on the esketamine, and they're also in therapy. But these are patients where everything else has failed, and there's almost no hope for these people. So doing one or two things like this, I think that is life-changing, and I'm very proud to say that it's very common in our state.
And if you guys are interested in this, our next episode is going to dive a little bit deeper into the uses of ketamine in like a more of a lifestyle and less of like the pre-hospital field. And I think that can be really valuable for first responders, because we all know that PTSD is something that is really big in our field. We also know that a lot of first responders were also first responders in another capacity before they started doing EMS. A lot of people are ex-military. Some are ex-law enforcement. People have come from different areas as well. And so PTSD is pretty rampant.
And esketamine is actually becoming a first line. It's becoming a first line intervention for severe PTSD.
That's awesome.
And a lot of the mechanisms that we've already talked about, the dissociation and some of that dosing, it can assist you in addressing some traumatic events without having as big of an emotional reaction to it. And so if you guys have ever heard of exposure therapy or behavioral cognitive therapy, things like that, ketamine can be an adjunct tool for those things, which is cool. So our next episode is going to dive deeper into that. But for today, for this episode, we are wrapped up with our ketamine uses in pre-hospital med. And we are going to move on to some trivia. So,
my favorite part of the episode.
What would be concerning in a patient's history that would kind of contraindicate you giving ketamine? This is more specifically for a hypermetabolic behavioral emergency patient, that you would want to negate ketamine and probably just use benzos.
They already beat my once on ketamine.
PCP. If you have a suspicion of them using PCP, because their chemical structures are very similar, so they potentiate each other.
Oh my gosh, I did not know that.
I will tell you that if a patient is on PCP,
you will know.
They will tell you.
Yes.
What year was ketamine first approved for human use by the FDA?
1970.
When did EMS start in our state?
1972.
How many years did it take to get on the truck?
1,000.
Feels like it.
Math.
What, we got in on the truck in what, 20?
Yeah, we didn't get it until 2018.
That is slow and steady, maybe runs the race, I don't know. Ketamine was originally developed as a safer alternative to which drug?
PCP. Oh, see?
That's why it potentiates.
Here's my follow-up question. What is the chemical name or the pharmaceutical name of PCP?
Phencyclidine.
In which form is esketamine commonly administered for depression?
Intranasal.
Yeah. How quickly can ketamine reduce depressive symptoms in some patients?
Hours.
Within hours.
It's pretty incredible.
What type of pain conditions is ketamine increasingly being used to treat?
Chronic.
What street name is commonly associated with ketamine when used recreationally?
Special K.
What neurotransmitter system does ketamine primarily affect?
Glutamate.
Correct. Do-do-do-do. True or false, ketamine promotes neuroplasticity, helping the brain form new connections.
True. Well, that was really fun. We love talking about ketamine. We are very fascinated by it.
Yeah, as we all should about be. It.
What?
Yeah, just talking about
Stop,
ketamine.
We're going to go to prison.
All right.
Not jail. Prison.
Prison.
To prison.
All right. So ketamine is fun, but you just got to be careful. So it works really well for a lot of things. It is very versatile, and sometimes so versatile that it's not even in protocols. So make sure to consult medical direction when necessary.
On our next episode, we're going to be talking about some lifestyle choices, changes, fun things to do.
Yeah, including sobriety, mental health, and a few other things. You'll have to check in next week to find out. Stay safe, and we'll see you so soon.
But also, check us on our socials and follow us on anything that you can, and then listen to our podcast on all the things that you listen to podcasts on.
Yes, and maybe TikTok will be gone tomorrow, but actually, this is going to come out after that.
After TikTok.
If you are listening to this on Monday, January 20th, and we are pre-recording this, please let us know if we survived the TikTok ban. Also, speaking of social media, and digital communications, if you have any stories to share with us, we would love for you to email us at lifeandsirenspod@gmail.com. That's lifeandsirenspod@gmail.com. Talk to you soon.
This has been Life and Sirens, produced by three nerds trying to bring you content that you might actually care about.